You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. In 1980, nearly 36 million workers, or 46% of the private sector jobs, were covered by a pension plan. That was the peak, and as people live longer and the private sector cuts costs, pensions cover fewer and fewer retirees. More than half of all retirees are now in so-called defined contribution plans, such as IRAs and 401ks. This requires saving and investing wisely, which is challenging to many Americans. Susan Antilla, an award-winning journalist and reporting fellow at the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, looked into how the experts who are supposed to help novice investors have, until now, little obligation to look out for the interests of their clients. Her article, "The Advice Trap: Financial Advisors Want to Rip Off Small Investors, Trump Wants to Help Them Do It," appears in Intercept in partnership with the Investigative Fund. And that's what brings Susan Antilla to the show. And it's like old home week, because Susan and I, like, we're sitting right now across from each other, sat across from each other when we were at Bloomberg News. It's wonderful to see you again.
It's
after all these
years.
It's
great to see you again too, John.
All right. So pensions have been around since 1875, when American Express first offered them to their employees, but life expectancy was only 49 years old then, and 75% of those age 65 years or older were still working. So pensions were meant to help create a professional workforce. Why have they been put on the corporate chopping block? Is it because of law changes? Is it because of cutting costs? Is it because of tax changes? Why did it happen?
It happened because of cost cutting. I mean, companies saw that that was a place where they could shave some of their costs, and they got rid of it, especially with corporate raiders and activists coming after them. It was a place where they could satisfy people who were coming after them.
And was this, so when did this happen? Was this in the 1980s? When you said corporate, you know, like the corporate raiding and stuff like that, that made me think of the 80s.
Yes, in the 80s and 90s is when that started happening. And up until then, we have this law called ERISA that protects retirement money. And so that law was really looking at pensions, not at the stuff that we have today, which is IRAs and 401ks.
And so did IRAs and 401ks pop up because of the reduction in pensions?
No, they were there anyway.
They were already there.
But they weren't used very widely. And now that there are really no other options for most people at work, now everybody has a 401k if they can, if their company offers it.
Do you know what percentage of how much are we supposed to pay? If you're doing the 401k or the IRA, is there a legal limit to how much you can put in?
You know, there is, and I don't know that off the top of my head.
Yeah, I used to know it. I think it's not much. It's not like 50% of your income. It's like 12 or 15, depending on how much you make.
Right.
Right. Like one of the stories you tell in your article is the one of Stephen Wingate, who became convinced he should take his retirement savings and entrust them to a financial advisor. Tell the rest of the story here.
Oh, this poor man. This is a former supervisor at a manufacturing company in Sycamore, Illinois. He was somebody who put away 10% of his income every year. He did everything that the experts tell us to do, right? And he had $282,000 in an IRA, in the exact perfect stuff. He was partly in a Fidelity fund, I think also a Vanguard fund. These were funds that had fees, annual management fees of 0.5%. And he got something in the mail one day from this financial advisor saying that he was an expert in retirement, and why don't you come to one of my seminars, my lunch seminars, and learn more about planning your retirement life. And so he went to one of these things at Johnny's Char House Restaurant in Sycamore, Illinois, with a bunch of other people who were retirement age. And so this advisor told him that, you know, he had all ideas of safe investments for these people, you know, that they could count on him, very conservative guy. And so he went along with it. He went with his wife, met with him privately, and handed over his whole IRA to him.
Now, in your story, you make a point of saying that in the literature that Mr. Wingate got Jack Tobota,
right,
that at the bottom of the literature that Jack Tobota sent to Mr. Wingate, he made a point of saying that he's been with his wife for 30-something years and that they belong to such and such church. And you also point out that, you know, that wasn't the thing that swayed Mr. Wingate. It was, it sounded like he was the perfect person to help advise him. And then what happened?
Well, he went into his office and, you know, he told him he wanted safe stuff. And so Toboda suggested to him that he go into non-traded real estate investment trusts, known as REITs. These are some of the riskiest investments that you could possibly make. And there actually is a study that shows that over the past 25 years, you would have done the same or better if you just had been in treasury bills. And when you take on a risky investment, you're supposed to make more than treasury bills. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he talked him into putting all of his money into several non-traded REITs, a little bit of money into an annuity too. And time went on, and a few years later, his $10 a share REIT had fallen to $4.25 a share. And he sort of said, what's going on here? You told me that this was safe. You told me that this was exactly the conservative thing that I should do with my money. And he held on to it until last year. He went to another financial advisor last year, and that person said, look, you know, you just got to get out of this because you're not going to get your money back. And so he lost half of his money.
Was it $149,000 out of the $282,000 he handed over to this person?
That's right.
You also write that while Mr. Wingate was signing the papers through all this, he, like everyone should do when they're signing papers, he was reading the papers, and one of them said, you could lose some, if not all, of your investments by doing this. And he asked Mr. Toboda, hey, wait a minute, what about this? And Mr. Toboda said, oh, that's standard. Don't worry, it'll never happen.
Right, right.
And it did.
Right. And by the way, that's what Wingate said to me. Mr. Toboda declined to comment, so I didn't get to hear from him. But yeah, he said that it was safe. It was okay.
Was there any, at the time Mr. Wingate was doing this, were there any regulations at all governing what Toboda could and couldn't do, should or shouldn't say to people about their investments?
There are regulations. The problem with Toboda was that he was only subject to what's called a suitability standard. So he would, as long as he could say that this was suitable for him, which is a pretty low bar, he was going to be okay. Now, there's a much higher standard called a fiduciary standard. And under a fiduciary, that's when you have to pick investments in the investor's best interest, their interest before yours. And this particular thing that he put him in got him 7% commission, $20,000
right off the top.
So, yes, there are regulations. Do they apply in that situation? He definitely wasn't being held to a fiduciary standard. Does the suitability standard mean that he's going to owe this guy money? Some FINRA arbitrators will look at this in November.
To go back to REITs for a second, because I wanted to point out something that Craig McCann, who's a former economist at the SEC, who had studied the poor performance and conflicts related to non-traded REITs, which was what you were talking about. And he said in a 2014 blog post, quote, no investors should buy these illiquid, high-commissioned, poorly diversified, non-traded REITs, and no unconflicted broker would recommend them.
That's pretty strong language, right? I mean, they're terrible investments.
And yet they are still out there. People are pushing people into them.
That's right.
And there's nothing to stop them from doing it.
Well, this fiduciary rule, this controversial Department of Labor fiduciary rule that went into partial effect in June, probably would have made that, an illegal, an illegal transaction. But barring that, no, people can still sell this stuff.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Susan Antilla about her story in The Intercept entitled The Advice Trap. Financial advisors want to rip off small investors. Trump wants to help them do it. Let's talk more about how President Trump wants to help financial advisors rip off the small investor. This rule that went into effect from the Department of Labor was supposed to go into effect in April, but it was delayed until
June 9th.
Until June 9th. Talk about what happened here.
Well, this was a 7-year quest to get this very good rule in effect that would make anybody giving retirement advice have to stick to a fiduciary standard, what I referred to before, a best interest standard. And the securities and insurance industries just went crazy over this. But after 6.5 years of fighting, the rule finally became effective last April of 2016, with the idea that it would be implemented this April. And Trump came in and said, I want to review this again. Let's look at this again. Maybe we're going to rescind it. Maybe we're going to change it. And so all of a sudden, everything was thrown out again to sort of take this rule away that would protect people. And so Trump, in the meantime, he has a new Securities and Exchange Commission chairman and a new Department of Labor chairman. And those people are working on his behalf to get rid of this rule, to lower some of these standards.
Before President Trump came into office, didn't Speaker Paul Ryan try to kill this rule when President Obama was still in office?
That's right. There was legislation that Obama vetoed. And I can't remember Ryan's exact quote, but I think he called it Obamacare for financial planning or something like that. Yes. Mm-hmm. So the Republicans have been trying to get rid of this. And under Obama, they couldn't.
How I'm just on my little moral high horse. Well, maybe because it's involving people's money. But the idea that there are people out there who are knowingly advising people to do things that will lose them money just strikes me as something that for people who profess to have the working person's ideals and interests at heart, willingly doing things that hurt the working person, the striving person.
Right. Well, they are handsomely rewarded for selling the worst investments. I mean, really, the worse the investment is, the bigger the commissions necessary to get people. It's almost like you've got to bribe somebody to sell it. You know, I'm using the word bribery loosely here.
Loosely, right.
But, you know, nobody would sell these non-traded REITs if they didn't have a 7% commission. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would you do that? You'd sell them something else, right?
Right.
There are terrible incentives in place.
I want to talk a little bit more about the incentives when we come back on the other side. I'm Jonathan Capehart, filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Susan Antilla about her story in The Intercept, The Advice Trap. Financial advisors want to rip off small investors. Trump wants to help them do it. We'll be right back after the break. Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm speaking with Susan Antilla about her story in The Intercept called The Advice Trap. Financial advisors want to rip off small investors. Trump wants to help them do it. And before we went to a break, you were talking about the incentives that these financial advisors are given to basically sell to their clients things that really shouldn't be sold to them. We were talking about Mr. Wingate and, you know, Tobota, the financial advisor who convinced him to take his $282,000 of retirement savings and hand it over to him. And 7% right off the top went to Mr. Tobota, $20,000. But and those were just in fees. But there are other things that are done to get financial advisors to pitch products to clients.
Well, all kinds of things. And I actually brought you some show and tell today from some of the insurance companies are particularly bad about this stuff because they sell annuities that are very high commission products. And so they send out these flyers to the brokers saying, you know, if you sell X amount of this stuff, we're going to send you to Hawaii, we're going to send you to the Turks and Caicos, we're going to send you to Dublin. And I have one right here, a Dublin thing, and at the very bottom of it, it says, not to be forwarded to customers. I mean, they know that if customers knew about this, they wouldn't buy the stuff. It's no secret to the industry, any of the financial industries or insurance, it's no secret that if people actually understood what they're doing, they wouldn't buy it.
Mm-hmm. Let me see that, and let me ask you, this reminds me of the whole situation with, with pharmaceuticals and doctors, you know, being wined and dined and and everything. And I think they put a clamp down on that. But yeah, here's this flyer you're showing. Leaders Conference 2017. We're Dublin, June 4th through the 8th, 2017, and pitching these advisors to these questionable products to consumers. You know, in July of 2009, you wrote that Phyllis Borzi, who had just been sworn in as Assistant Secretary charged with running the Employee Benefits Security Administration, had asked her 9 office directors to come prepared with a list of their top priorities, the issues they would want on the agency's agenda if they had her job. What did she learn?
Well, she learned that her investigators we're finding all kinds of problems with 401ks, especially with small company sponsors. So, you know, you have the K-Part company and you want to offer 401ks for your employees. And so you hire a broker to give you advice about what to offer in that 401k. Well, what was happening was the broker might give you terrible advice and high commission products. You follow that advice, and you were responsible. You were the only one with a fiduciary duty, but the broker did not have that duty. And so that is what Phyllis Borzi and her staff at DOL started working on. Like, they had to broaden the number of people who were responsible for bad advice. They needed more legal clout, really.
Mm-hmm. And it was this as a result of the financial implosion in 2008 that they focused on this?
It actually was not. She had just become assistant secretary, and she wanted to get to know her staff. And she said, look, I want you to come into the next meeting and tell me what you would, as you said before, what you would do if you had my job. And almost everybody in the room said the same thing, that we don't have the legal tools to go after the people who are really giving the bad advice, who were outside brokers who had no responsibility from a regulatory point of view.
And that was, and she was at the Employee Benefits Security Administration, which is in which agency is that?
That's the Department of Labor.
Department of Labor. The SEC has a hand in all of this. What's the SEC's role?
Well, the SEC has consistently dropped the ball on this issue. Back in 2005, they actually admitted that investors had no idea of the difference between people who were brokers, who were just salespeople, and people who were advisors who had a fiduciary duty to them. The public just didn't know. They admitted that the public was confused. They did focus groups where people said, I have no idea. Is he an advisor? Is he a what? I mean, they had all the information right there, and they did absolutely nothing. And one of the reasons they said they were doing nothing, because they said that if they told brokers what they could not call themselves, that they would just come up with some new misleading names. And this is all about the regulatory thing. A stockbroker does not have a fiduciary standard. An investment advisor does. But over the years, stockbrokers began to portray themselves as advisors who keep your best interests in mind, which is not true.
You know, a listener called in and says that we're glossing over that these investments are not a REIT. It was a non-traded security and was illiquid. Up to you to use or not use. So what this sounds like is this listener is trying to say that Mr. Wingate, it's his fault.
Well, Mr. Wingate was paying a handsome commission to Mr. Tabota to give him advice. So,
right.
I mean, how could it be the investor's fault? The investor went to the guy, and the guy made money to give him advice.
Right. I mean, to my mind, you know, when you go to someone seeking advice, particularly when it comes to money, and especially when it comes to your retirement savings, and Mr. Wingate was close to retirement, so he was like very mindful of what was happening with his money. And when you are handing over, maybe unwittingly to Mr. Wingate's mind, 7% of your money right off the top, you kind of expect that the person you're talking to has your best interests at heart, is doing things that are beneficial to you, not beneficial to him or her, that person who is supposed to be your financial advisor.
Right. And, you know, I hear this argument all the time. They should have known better. Well, why should they have known better? I mean, when I go buy a car, I don't have an inspector come and look at it. You know, if I buy a new car, I buy the new car. I read some consumer reports. So this expectation that the public understands these products that, frankly, the stockbrokers don't understand much of the time is ridiculous. And in many cases, the industry is deliberately confusing about what they're offering. You know, they don't tell, I mean, the fine print, if you really have a lawyer's sort of mind, you might be able to figure out the risk. I mean, they are not making it easy for anybody to evaluate these products.
It's like they're out there willfully trying to steal your money.
Right. And by the way,
I know I'm being a bit hyperbolic, but that's what it sounds like.
Well, and you know, Jonathan, when a product blows up, like auction rate securities, or there was something called principal protected notes during the financial crisis, these awful products. The first thing that happens is the brokers are let off the hook because they say, well, we didn't understand there was something wrong with it. It was a defective product. How did we know? I mean, this goes around a circle. Why go to these people if they're not going to understand what they're selling you, number one, and number two, sell you the thing that's right for you?
So maybe this is a question for before we go off, because I'm sitting here thinking, how do people know who to trust? But let's talk about, we've talked about the Department of Labor and what they're doing. We talked about the SEC and what they're not doing. What about Dodd-Frank? What role did Dodd-Frank, or does Dodd-Frank, play in all of this?
Well, Dodd-Frank certainly brought in some important consumer protections. I would say, most importantly, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which, as you know, is under fire by Republicans, and Trump would like to, you know, get rid of the director who has done really important things for small investors. Now, that's not securities; that's more banking products that they are regulating. But I would say that was the most important thing for the general public that came out of Dodd-Frank, and then, you know, all of the other protections to make banks and brokerage firms safer. But one-on-one for the public, I think that was the most important thing that happened.
Now, by October 2010, and this was after Dodd-Frank was signed into law, Ms. Borzi, who we talked about from the Department of Labor, and her team, they designed and proposed the fiduciary rule that would shut down ERISA's loopholes. And I know you mentioned ERISA earlier, but talk about ERISA, what it is and what those loopholes are.
So ERISA is this regulation to protect retirement money, which, as I said, mostly was meant to protect pensions, which we don't have very many of anymore. But to qualify, to be defined as a fiduciary under ERISA, you had to be giving regular advice to somebody. So that theoretical person I spoke about before, the broker who just gives one-time advice, hey, put these mutual funds in your 401k, he was not responsible for anything. There also was this funny qualification. Before you were considered a fiduciary, you had to have a mutual understanding with your client that your advice was the basis of them making the investment, which is like kind of crazy. Like, you're giving the advice. Why are you giving the advice if not to have them make an investment, right? But those things gave brokers the ability to say, well, I didn't know they were going to use my advice.
How is that even? Oh, come on, Susan. How is that?
You know, John, people win cases with these things. I mean, brokers win cases. It is so easy to escape responsibility. And this is a little bit of a diversion, but I want to say this about the securities industry. For 30 years, the securities industry has not been subject to being sued in court. And that's extraordinary. You know, there's been a lot of publicity about this so-called mandatory arbitration. Wall Street invented it. In 1987, they won a very important Supreme Court case. And so for 30 years, this industry has become accustomed to not being publicly held accountable. And I'll tell you, that makes a big difference. And some of these things that you and I are saying, how could that be? I think that's why that is, because they don't get hauled into court.
So, I mean, this goes to explain why a lot of people don't like Wall Street. A lot of people don't trust Wall Street, don't trust the financial services industry, think that the system's rigged against them, because just in this example, the system is rigged against them. And then you have politicians who campaign on being the voice of people who've been harmed and wronged by the system. And elect that person to positions of responsibility. And then you find out that that person who you put in office because you thought they were going to fight for you is actually doing things that actually help the people who are rigging the system. Of course, I'm talking about President Trump, who has tried to scuttle, do away with, and the Department of Labor rule. You mentioned before that it went into effect in June. That's meant to protect consumers.
Right.
Is there anything else President Trump can do to actually succeed in his fight to scuttle this rule?
Well, yes, and he's doing it. The rule was to be phased in two parts. So on June 9th, the first part took effect. And it's incredible to think that you had to have a rule for this. But the initial part of the rule said that brokers have to act in customers' best interest. This only applies to retirement accounts, by the way. They can only charge a reasonable fee, and they have to avoid misleading statements. This was the outrageous suggestion of the Department of Labor. I think most people walking down the street, if you ask them, you know, does your broker, you know,
do any of those things?
You know, I mean, they would say, you know, yeah, my broker acts in my best. So that was phase one. Phase two was set to kick in next January. And this is the part that the industry really goes nuts about. Phase two will make them legally accountable. So that if you sell a commission product as of January, you have to enter a contract with your customer that says you're going to act in their best interest. And once you have a contract, you can go after somebody for breaking the contract.
Yeah, you can sue, which you said before. Well, it makes it really difficult.
And so you can't actually sue because you're going to be stuck in FINRA arbitration. But one thing that's really driving them nuts is that the Department of Labor has said that you can actually bring a class action suit as of January of 2018. Hmm. If these rules are violated. So the industry is going crazy about that. However, Trump's new labor secretary this week said that he wants to delay that from January of 2018 to July of 2019, which will give them a chance to water down the rule.
And also push it past the midterm elections. But that's just my little Washington political...
I'm sure it's just a coincidence.
My political mind working. We have another question from a listener who's asking, and I'm not sure if you know the answer, but I'm putting it out there. If retirement income certified professionals certification includes a fiduciary responsibility to their clients...
Well, they don't have a fiduciary responsibility unless they are what's called a registered investment advisor, that's a very specific thing. You mm-hmm. you know, you are regulated in a certain way by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And not that they're all angels, but if they break the rules, they are judged by a fiduciary standard. Mm-hmm. And for retirement accounts, that's what the DOL was trying to ramp up a bit. Mm-hmm. Those people actually, they are held to that standard. Stockbrokers are not. And so the DOL rule would make stockbrokers held to that standard as well.
So you spent this entire time talking about like all the things that financial advisors and all these folks can do to prey upon people who are coming to them for help,
right,
with their life savings. Or trying to grow their savings. But we haven't even talked about whether, and all the forces that are out there to protect their interests. But is there a lobbying effort? Are there lobbyists out there for consumers? Does Mr. Wingate have an association that he didn't know about of people lobbying on his behalf?
There are lobbyists, but... there are consumer lobbyists who are quite effective. There just are so few of them compared to the lobbyists for the industry. And the numbers are just, you know, I think last year consumer groups spent $23 million lobbying related to the fiduciary rule and other things. And by comparison, business groups spent $187 million. So that you can see it's a very lopsided fight. Mm-hmm. But yes, there are consumer groups... Better Markets. There are lots of consumer groups out there that do a Public Citizen that do a great job, but they don't have the money that industry has. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned during one of the breaks a quote from Gary Cohn, who is the president's, I think he's the head of the National Economic National Economic Council,
right.
Or chief economic advisor. And what did Gary Cohn say?
Gary Cohn said of the DOL rule that it was like putting only healthy food on the menu because unhealthy food tastes good, but you still shouldn't eat it because you'll die younger.
Talk about please explain.
Well, what he's saying is, yeah, this stuff that people are selling will make your finances die younger. Yes, it's bad for you, but we're not going to take it off the menu. I mean, it was an extraordinary statement. He said that to the Wall Street Journal.
So we're not going to help you. So other translation, we're not going to help you protect your health, protect your financial well-being.
No.
That's not on us. We have no role in this. That's on you.
And, you know, I should say one thing. There are a lot of honest, terrific people giving financial advice. They tend to be investment advisors, registered investment advisors who are held to the higher duty. And something that's been happening as there's been a lot of publicity about this issue, those people are getting more business because the public is seeing, oh, that's the kind of person I should be with. And so this has been a good thing for the people who are held to a high standard. And, you know, so there are people who give good advice and who you can trust.
Should someone just go on the internet and just look for a registered financial
investment advisor.
That's the person they should be looking to.
That's what I would do.
In the less than a minute that we have left, you've been covering this world for a long time. You've seen it all. Have you, in reporting this or any of the other things, are you surprised by anything that you learn that the financial world does to consumers?
You know, at this point, nothing surprises me. I hate to say that, but some of the tactics and we didn't get into this, but the dirty tactics and the untrue things that they put in their comment letters on these things, they make stuff up. Nothing really surprises me at this point.
And does it surprise you that the federal government hasn't succeeded in curbing the worst practices of that industry?
I guess it does not surprise me anymore because I'm aware of how much money politicians get from the insurance, banking, and securities industry. And I think it makes it very hard for them to turn their backs on the people who give them all this funding.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I've been speaking with Susan Antilla about her story in The Intercept, The Advice Trap. Financial advisors want to rip off small investors. Trump wants to help them do it. Thanks so much, Susan. It's so great to see you again after all these years.
Thanks for having me.